Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Over the past several months, we featured a couple podcasts dealing with the state of higher education, with a particular eye towards the place of Christian colleges in that landscape. Our first interview, back in July, was with Joseph Castleberry, the president of Northwest University, who painted a rather optimistic picture of where his institution is heading and the future for Christian schools more generally. A few weeks later, we followed up with Hunter Baker, the dean of instruction at Union University, who had a less sanguine view, but still saw the possibility for great things to come with religious universities. Given that we did these two interviews in a relatively short span of time, I thought I would shelve the topic of Christian education for a little while. But then I came across a posting on the Pietas Schoolmen blog, a blog run by today's guest, Chris Gerrits, who had a much more pessimistic perspective on things. Chris's posting was entitled, "An Open Letter to American Churches, The Crisis of Christian Higher Education." That salvo generated enough attention from the public at large that it prompted him to follow up with a postscript. With something this good, in addition to my general interest in the future of higher education, how could I pass up the opportunity to talk with Professor Gerrits? I should note that Chris is a professor in and chair of the Department of History at Bethel University in St. Paul, Minnesota, where he also coordinates the Christianity and Western Culture program. While his training is in the history of international relations and 20th century Europe, he teaches about everything from human rights to the Reformations, and is the co-editor of the Pietist Impulse in Christianity, part of the Princeton Theological Monograph series. And he also has a forthcoming volume entitled Whole and Holy Persons, A Pietist Approach to Christian Higher Education, that is due out next fall with InterVarsity Press. We will highlight that book when it comes out. And also, as I noted, he blogs at the Pietist Schoolmen, a site that we will link to on our website so that you can link to it as well. Chris, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks, Tony. Thanks for getting the last name right, by the way. That's rare.
Yeah, I was in a little bit of a rush to give you a call here. I didn't know how to pronounce it, so it is Gerrits,
well,
right?
You must have taken some German at some point. That's usually the tell.
My wife is partially German. So
there you go.
Yeah, it must be it. And speaking of Germans, I should note that the Nordic heritage or the Northern European heritage, we're recording this podcast on Tuesday, October 22nd, and this is just one day after Chris's beloved Minnesota Vikings were shellacked by the lowly New York Giants on Monday Night Football, a big national audience there. So you might not only be sad about the state of higher education, but you might be sad about football too. So suffice it to say, I am here to cheer you up, as I tend to be a little bit more bullish, not only on the state of Christian schools in our country, but also in football in Minnesota.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I would say otherwise. We've always got the Timberwolves to look forward to, or the Twins past that. It's hard to be a sports fan in Minnesota right now.
Yeah.
I feel like more I need to apologize on behalf of the state of Minnesota to everyone who watched that game.
Oh, that's okay.
That's nice. I just feel like somewhere there is someone was watching football for the first time and they saw that. I hope they can recover.
Yeah. That's, I have another question for you. Sure. When I read your introduction, I use the word pietist quite a bit. You blog on the Pietist Schoolmen. You're writing a book called A Pietist Approach to Christian Education. What is all this pietism stuff?
Sure. And that could take up an hour by itself. But the quick version is pietism historically is a movement mostly in Protestant Christianity in the late 17th, early 18th century. So it's Philip Spener and August Franke, and it emphasizes Christianity's experience more than as intellectual assent, creeds and confessions and such. So it tends to emphasize new birth, new life, conversion, sanctification. Tends to take a more Irenic approach to controversies, tend to emphasize missions, charity, and to some extent education. So, like you said, my training is historian of international relations. I teach European history. But when I came to Bethel, it was, you know, part of the journey I might talk about is just I didn't go to a Christian college, and so learning what it meant to integrate faith and learning. But I started to pick up on the fact that a lot of that language comes from the Reformed tradition, and while that's valuable, it didn't quite resonate with my own upbringing in the Covenant Church, and I didn't really feel like it squared with Bethel heritage, which is Baptist and Pietist. So my research has kind of taken a left turn into what would Pietism do to a Christian model of higher education, and so that's where the university book is coming from.
Now, wait a minute. I have to ask you for a little bit of a clarification here. You said you did not go to a Christian school.
I did not. No,
but you wait a minute. Wait a minute here. You graduated from Yale University with your PhD. If I am correct, there is such a thing known as the Yale Divinity School, is there not?
There is, indeed. I went there a few times. It has a nice little library. I did some research on just war theory. And Yale, at one point, I think would have called itself a Christian college or university. While I was there, I think it finished whatever ties it had left with the United Church of Christ. And if anything, it's a historic kind of identity.
Oh, okay.
In my wing of the institution, I actually would say I knew plenty of Christians, and I didn't sense the same kind of antagonism as some people do in other wings of the institution. But you've discovered my secret. I actually managed to come through a non-Christian college experience. All right.
Okay. Yeah, well, there you have it. Now you're at Bethel University out there in Minnesota. And the letter that you put on your blog, The Pietist Schoolman, was in reaction to a crisis that a budgetary crisis that was befalling the university. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. But it generated some thoughts on your part that led to this posting about a crisis in Christian higher education. Describe to us what that crisis is.
Yeah, and I hope I'm not engaging recklessly and hyperbole here. And it could be we'll look back in 10 years and, you know, this will all be overblown. There was a crisis in the 1980s driven largely by demographic change, I think, when enrollment at places like Bethel dropped. I think we lost 25% of our students. And then the 90s, 2000s, we recovered. But I think partially it's tied to a larger, if not crisis, restructuring of higher education. And it seems that smaller private tuition-dependent colleges seem especially susceptible to it, and they're especially nervous about what it means and wondering if they can weather it. I just know from my own experience, it seems like it's increasingly hard to recruit and retain students, and there are a lot of factors there, probably starting with the cost of tuition and the other expenses of it. But yeah, there's been some research done broadly on higher education and financial problems, and so one thing I noticed was when Forbes came out with its financial grades for, if it was about 1,500 or 1,200 schools. Schools in our consortium, the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities, generally did worse than the rest of the schools in the test. About three-quarters got a C or a D, and they didn't give an F, but I think some would have gotten an F. And that was, I think, overall, it was about 60% were C or D. So it seems like even specific to evangelical colleges and universities, maybe there's some financial problems that we need to be especially wary of.
You said something rather interesting, that your enrollments at Bethel dropped in the 1980s and then recovered, probably about a decade ago. So you're looking at a maybe decade and a half gap between the 80s, 90s, and then starting to recover. Now, I know you weren't at Bethel in the 1980s, so I'm not going to put the blame on you. But has there been any thought about what was going on in the 1980s and 1990s that students just said, hey, we are not coming here, and then had some turnaround in about a decade ago?
Yeah, I mean, I think generally it's attributed to the just generally a fall off in the population of college-going students in places like Minnesota at that point. I mean, it's partly that Bethel had expanded so dramatically, starting coming out of World War II when it became a four-year college, and fueled in part by federal and state government investment in things like the GI Bill and other kinds of grants and loans. There was kind of rising prosperity of evangelicals generally, and so Bethel doubled and then doubled again over the course of maybe 25 to 30 years. in the process it moved to a newer campus out in the suburbs. But yeah, I think it's probably fair to say that that was done on pretty flimsy support, that it grew very quickly and maybe didn't have the infrastructure that it needed. Yeah, I think for a long time in the 70s, you know, there's shortages of buildings. You know, people are going to class while they're constructing and fixing things. So that was maybe a very attractive package. I mean, I think the other thing that happened is, to some extent, in the 70s, it seems like the percentage of students from the denomination started to drop. And so I know one factor in the recovery was that the new president, George Brushaber, actually made a concerted effort to reach out to those churches again. And I think got up to maybe 40% students came from the denomination's churches. And we might talk more about that today later in the interview.
But yeah, so wait, if I understand your strategy correct, Bethel is booming or growing in the 1960s and 70s, and it's just saying, hey, we'll take whoever comes, you, 17, 18, 19-year-old, you look pretty good, get over here. But then there was a strategy to focus more on the denominations, go to the Baptist churches and say, send us your students.
Well, I mean, I think what was happening was, you know, I mean, in the 60s, I want to say 60% of students came from those churches. And I haven't seen it. The statistics for the 70s are a little sketchier, but it seems like over the 70s, whether it was an intent to recruit more broadly and become a little bit less of a denominational school, or yeah, I think to some extent it was outgrowing its kind of ethnic Swedish enclave identity and trying to recruit from beyond, not just the churches, but from beyond that population. But I think maybe there's a sense that they, you know, there was a population there that would probably like to come to Bethel, but was being taken for granted or wasn't being recruited very intensively. And so that, I know, was one strategy that helped recover enrollment, was reaching back out to the denomination. My sense, though, in the 90s, and I came to Bethel in 2003, is that that didn't take long to reverse. And nowadays, I think something like 20% of our students come from the denomination, which is still maybe the biggest group. It's kind of neck and neck with non-denominational churches.
Mm-hmm. So it's still, again, from the 1960s/70s, it's a half, 50% drop in the number of you get from the denominational schools. Is it in that in part because the denominational affiliation that you're pulling from is struggling? You mentioned that you're a Baptist school. Is a specific brand of Baptist? Are you Southern Baptist? Are you American Baptist? What are you, folks?
Sure. It's now known as Converge Worldwide. Formal name and the name for most of Bethel's history is the Baptist General Conference, or up until World War II, it was the Swedish Baptist General Conference. This started 1850s or so. You get Swedish Baptists migrating to North America. So places, especially in the Midwest, but also New Jersey, Connecticut, California, parts of Canada. And that was the identity for a long time. You know, it actually, Bethel started in 1871 as a Swedish seminary in Chicago, moved around, landed in St. Paul, and then it was an academy and a junior college, and then after World War II became the four-year school. So it's a little bit of an odd duck, my sense, in the Baptist world, unless you happen to know to look for it. I'm not sure you've noticed it. Most of those churches have dropped Baptist from their name now. I think something like 80% have dropped Baptist from their title. I think it is shaped a little bit by pietism that might give it a little bit of a distinctive, I was going to say edge, but probably lack of an edge. I think in 2007 or 8, it adopted what it called a missional name of Converge Worldwide. And I'm not part of the denomination, so I'm a little bit of an outsider to that. But I think the sense was the Baptist was in some ways a stumbling block for people.
Is that denomination, Converge Worldwide, is it growing? Is it stagnant? Is it declining?
Growing.
It is growing.
Probably not as fast as some of the other conservative evangelical denominations, but you know, certainly, I mean, even from the 80s, to the present day, I think membership in like the mid 80s was 130,000 or so. You know, probably it's added 10 or 20,000 members, and then beyond that, another 70 to 80,000. I want to say would attend on however they measure it, regular attendance. So, I mean, it hasn't grown by leaps and bounds, but it's certainly much bigger than it was when Bethel became a four-year college. And even in the last 20 years, it's continued to grow. You know, in the single digits at least. It hasn't seen the kind of drop off of Lutheran and Presbyterian and mainline denominations.
Okay, so there's a population that you can draw from, and we're going to talk to that issue a little bit later in the interview, talking about how do Christian colleges reverse this crisis and engage the denominations that associate with them or used to associate with them more fully. But I want to get back to the crisis. And you mentioned the Forbes list of financial health rankings of these various schools, schools generally, and the CCCU schools, the Christian colleges consortium, 74% of those received C's or below. 18 evangelicals actually received D's. You said nobody received F because that would basically mean you failed and went out of business.
Yeah,
but
I don't think they gave gentlemen's D's, I guess.
Yeah, gentlemen's D's, I guess. And that's not good. That's not a good sign.
No.
And in your blog posting, you cited an economist, Robert Archibald, who was the co-author of a book, Why Does College Cost So Much? And he framed the problem, this financial crisis in higher education, as somewhat of a trilemma, not a dilemma with dichotomous, but a trilemma, trichotomous problem here. And he says, quote, everyone has three objectives for higher education. One, lower tuition. Two, higher quality. And three, less government spending on subsidies. The unfortunate truth is that we can have any two of these, but we can't have all three. And so this raises that issue of the trade-offs being made here between lower tuition, higher quality, subsidies, et cetera, et cetera. Tuition is going up, and this has been noted for many years now, if not decades. College tuition always tends to be going up. What are the drivers that are going there in terms of that we can't have lower tuition because costs are going up? What's pushing that?
Yeah, and that's I don't think that's probably a settled question. I know it's been a pretty controversial debate on campus. I think from one perspective, I've heard administrators say that it's instructional costs and specifically faculty compensation. For example, it's worth noting that before Bethel faced its budget crisis, it adopted a new faculty compensation plan. I forget if it was the 80s or the 90s, but they had essentially flattened compensation because they couldn't compete at the junior level, and so they took away from the senior level. And so now we compete pretty well for entering pay, but we're becoming non-competitive at the level of full professors. And so they had moved to raise that. And that would be a fairly serious increase in that portion of the budget. I think the pushback against that is that if you adjust for things like inflation, it's, 1970 to 2010, it's not clear that that compensation has really gone up all that dramatically. But that partly might be because there's more use of adjuncts and other lower paid labor that don't get the same kind of benefits. I think the things faculty would be talking about would be rising costs for support services and not just even co-curricular, but things like IT and other the various amenities we increasingly feel that we have to offer to our students to draw them. Administrative costs. I forget how many vice presidents we have. I started in 2003, but I think we're up to 15 or 16 now.
Wow, that's more vice presidents than the United States. I think we only have one vice president in the United States.
Right, and then in addition to that, we've added layers of associate deans, both in academics and in student life and campus ministry. So that, I think there's been some question from the faculty of exactly how much that has cost, whether that's an appropriate kind of structure, and exactly what kind of return we get on that investment. The other one that you often hear is that colleges have simply been building too much, and they've been borrowing too heavily to pay for it. So I could talk about Bethel here, but I'll try to distract attention by pointing to Calvin College, which I think by all accounts is a very well-regarded Christian college in Grand Rapids, Michigan, associated with the Christian Reformed Church. And, pretty famously, earlier this year, had to lay off about 20 faculty and staff. It had to cut about $5 million from its budget. And if you read the coverage of this, it usually mentions that its long-term debt rose to about $115 million between 1997 and 2012. And debt service was over $6 million in the operating budget. And it was going to reach about 10% of the budget just to cover the payments on the debt. I'm not exactly sure how much that's driving our fiscal crisis. We had a pretty serious building program about 5 years ago. We have a $30 million university commons right outside my office. And just the timing of it was unfortunate. The campaign kicked off right before the recession hit, and people's portfolios took a substantial hit, and so some pledges didn't come in. And I'm not exactly sure how that was paid for, but I've got to imagine that's a problem. The other thing that's not related necessarily to tuition costs, but I think is a big factor in, like, the Forbes ratings would be endowments. Ours is historically low. I looked up in U.S. News before you called, and it says in 2012 our endowment was worth something like $25 million, which is peanuts compared to a place like, you're connected to Baylor, which is almost $1 billion. In many ways, the leading light in the Christian college world. I tried to crunch some numbers on this, and what I ended up with is, across the CCCU, the median endowment per full-time equivalent student is about $8,000, and nationally it's more like $9,000. So it's not drastically different, but that also, it's very different than, like, Lutheran colleges, which is probably about three times that high per student.
Yeah, that is it doesn't sound that much, 8,000 per student versus 9,000, but if you put it in percentage term, that's about 12% or so.
And for a lot of us, like Bethel's probably 5,000 or 6,000. So there's quite a spread across the concern. Places like Wheaton, I think it's more like 90,000 to 100,000. A lot of us are pretty low.
You bring up that issue of endowments, which come from charitable givings of your alumni. Also, that raises the issue of who else is pitching in to help subsidize this education. The issue that you brought up in your blog posting was denominations. To what extent are denominations chipping in? You're associated with the Converge Worldwide, or it used to be the Swedish Baptist. And do they have any responsibility, or do they feel any responsibility or any kind of contractual obligation that they give so much money every year? And what's been happening with that denominational money?
Sure. Yeah. I never fully understand the legal status. I know that the Bethel Corporation is actually the annual meeting of Converge Worldwide, or the Baptist General Conference. So it's a tighter tie than some colleges have. I'm not sure there's a contractual obligation, but there's a historic level of giving, but it's been dropping. I just went back through the annual reports of the BGC, which sees publication in 2005, but I've got a little bit more data that's more current. But, for example, going back, say, 30 years, in 1983, 1984, almost 20% of the denomination budget went directly to Bethel, which ended up being, in Bethel's budget, a little over 6% of the budget. And if you adjust for inflation, it's over $2 million they're giving each year. In 2005, the last year this was all public, the denomination was giving $300,000, which was 2% of its budget and about 0.4% of the Bethel budget. I've seen a little bit more. One of our vice presidents did his doctoral thesis on this very question. And one thing he did was, instead of looking at the denomination budget, was actually looking at what did churches give, whether it's directly church to college or indirectly through the denomination. And it's a very similar kind of pattern. Adjusting for inflation in the late 80s was probably $2 million total, and now it's down to around $300,000. So it's, I don't think it's really dropped any further since 2005, but it hasn't gone up a lot. The other thing that I noticed in his research is, at its high point, about 300 churches, regardless of the amount they gave, made at least some contribution out of, in 1990, would have been about 800 churches in the denomination, so 3 out of 8. And now it's less than 100, whether it's a direct or an indirect. And that fell off a lot after the recession hit in 2008. It fell by about 50%. Okay. So it's not great.
And so in terms of going back to Archibald's trilemma here, you want lower tuition, higher quality, and less government spending on subsidies, but subsidies in general. One of the things that's being affected here is that the subsidies from these denominations are dropping. So if you want to keep tuition low, you're going to have to find another source of subsidies to extent. And I just mentioned alumni. Right. So there's not only the denominations that are affiliated with your colleges, but there's the alumni. And can't you go out there and say, hey, you Bethel alumni, what's your nickname, by the way?
Oh, we're the Royals.
The Royals?
The Royals, yes.
Like the Kansas City Royals?
We think we have a lion as a mascot.
Okay. Yeah, okay. You Bethel Lions or you Bethel Royals. Didn't you forget your great 4 years here? Please come back and drop a big bag of money on us. How are alumni donations, not only for Bethel, but Christian colleges generally?
Yeah, it's a great question. I don't have data to give you. I did notice in your previous interview with Dr. Baker that was an issue he raised. The wherewithal of alumni to give, or the sense that maybe the giving is that they paid these high tuition costs, and after that they've got other things to give to, including their churches. I would say the general sense that I have, having been around Bethel for 11 years, is we've got some very faithful givers. On the whole, I don't know that we do especially well here. My guess is this is one of the things that drops us in something like the U.S. News ranking, the percentage of alumni that give. But I think the larger problem we face is where do we focus our development efforts? And rather than building endowments or doing endowing chairs or scholarships, it seems like usually it goes to fund building projects. So the University Commons I just mentioned, or there is, I think even a matching gift for the nursing department got a nice overhaul a couple of years ago. We're doing a fitness center, and probably the next big project piece is like a science building. And that was something that came up in the response to the open letter was, people mentioned the alumni giving issue, and there are alumni who said we ought to be doing more in this regard, but others said, yeah, but Bethel doesn't seem like a very good financial steward. It keeps building things they can't afford to pay for. It's not growing its endowment. So I think there's that reticence of alumni being a little bit wary of giving to a place that makes those kinds of choices.
There is a little bit of a trap there as well, as people want to give money, and they want to give money that shows that they've given money, and so they give it to buildings, and you get a building named after you. And so the money that you can raise is oftentimes something very physical, that building that could get you in trouble financially later on down the line. It's not the kind of stuff such as scholarships. You can put your name on scholarships, but it's not as visible. You mentioned the interview with Hunter Baker that we did a few weeks back, and we'll post a link to that on our website. And he did mention something very interesting, and it hadn't occurred to me. And there is this little paradox here as well with the Archibald's comment, is that alumni giving would seem to be a great source of revenue. You had a good time at Bethel or Baylor or wherever it might be. Please remember it fondly and give back your time. But on the other hand, the reason you're asking that is because tuition is going up. And with higher tuitions, people are going, well, wait, why do I have to give so much when tuition is so high? Aren't you getting that money from tuition? Or worse yet, is somebody paid a very high tuition maybe 10, 15 years ago, and they say, man, I already gave. Your tuition was high. Why are you asking me now to give? And then add to that mix, as Hunter Baker pointed out, the people who do attend these universities are usually devoted Christians, and they're donating to their churches or to other parachurch organizations to feed the world or et cetera, et cetera. It seems like there's some kind of dilemma. Has Bethel felt that? Have you seen that elsewhere?
I mean, one of the factors here, honestly, is I think faculty are just starting to wake up to some of these issues. I think we had the luxury for some flush years of saying, well, that was an alumni relations problem, that was development's problem. So, that's my sense is what's happening. One thing I can say is I did a post a while back using some Department of Education information to look at what is the median loan payment, for example, for Bethel, and it's about $240. And actually, in some respects, we do pretty well. We have one of the lowest loan default rates. So apparently, our students are able to get jobs that can pay for those loans. But, I think that inhibits giving as well. It's not just, you're either paying that tuition up front or you're going to pay it throughout your working life.
That's true.
Yeah, so, I think trap is a good word for it. And, I think we have some very generous individual donors. I just got an email half an hour ago saying someone had made a gift to set up a departmental research grant for us, which was fantastic. Mm-hmm. I really struggled writing the open letter because, in a sense, I wanted to initiate a conversation that I don't see happening. I also didn't want to sound ungrateful for the kind of generosity that we do have that pays for what I do. But my sense is there are other schools very much like this that find a way to do this better. I mentioned Calvin, mm-hmm. and a crisis in some ways, is at least as bad, maybe in some ways even worse than ours. But I mean, by even before their fiscal year was done, I think there were $3 million over their fundraising target, which was substantially higher than what our fundraising targets are. And one factor there is I wonder if we bring it back to denominational giving. The CRC it's kind of legendary for its stewardship. It has the highest rate, and it's not quite tithing, but it's, I think, 6 or 7%, according to the last study I saw.
And the CRC being the Calvinist Reformed Church?
Right. The Christian Reformed Church.
Reformed Church, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, the Calvin alumni I know in our faculty, this is their take, is, well, I mean, we'll be fine because we have alumni who give very faithfully. And that's just, and they view a very close connection between the denomination and the college. There are other costs there, which is, Calvin faculty, I think, or at least up until recently, still have to be members of CRC churches. And so there's an unusually high degree of alignment or commitment between the denomination and the college there. It's a fairly cohesive culture then. You go to Calvin, you support Calvin, you send your kids to Calvin. I'm not sure that Pietas Baptists have that kind of understanding of the nature of church and its relationship to the college.
You mentioned that you just received a grant for a research program, which is really good, because what oftentimes happens is alumni who donate usually want, as we mentioned, give to buildings, things that have their names on it, or number two, give to undergraduate students. And it's usually those research grants or research endowments that are third on the list or even farther down on the list. And people don't understand that, research is important, but we need to be giving to undergraduate students. But it's those research funds that draw the faculty, the high quality faculty, to universities. And that's the people who end up teaching.
It's true. And I think it is a kind of distinctive of Bethel within the Christian college world that, especially certain departments like physics really are, well regarded. And it's partly because the variability to draw those funds, and then it becomes a draw for students too, because they're able to do collaborative research with faculty, and many go on to grad school. Part of that though is that we're now able to accept federal funds. So we've had, I think, two or three National Science Foundation grants from the physics department in the last couple of years that are each $250,000 or so. And that's been a historic kind of tension for Bethel. It's a recent development that we've accepted that kind of federal funding.
And that oftentimes can come with strings attached and stuff. And that's another source of revenue, though. And it's a way of dealing with this crisis. And so I want to move to the next portion of our discussion here, is that we just stated that Christian colleges are in a very tight financial situation. They don't want to raise tuitions. They still want to maintain high quality. And there's the question of, do we take NSF grants? Do we open up to other federal grants and subsidies? You, in your blog posting, posed a couple possible solutions to dealing with this financial crisis and basically juggling Archibald's trilemma of keeping tuition low, keeping higher quality education, relying less upon government spending and subsidies. What are some of these things? Maybe start with the most dramatic one that you mentioned.
Yeah, the most dramatic, and the one I didn't write as much about, but I think a lot about, is we might just have too many Christian, evangelical, especially Christian colleges and universities. I think there are three in Canada, and then I think right now there are 116 members of the CCCU, plus affiliates like Baylor and Pepperdine and Samford and a couple others. And it might be that's just too many, and especially in that D, C to D financial category, maybe some of those will close either by attrition or there'll be a strategic choice to close them. And what I didn't write so much about is I wrestle with the fact that churches close a lot. We talk about this within our denomination, that sometimes churches outgrow their founding purpose. The demographics change. For whatever reason, they close. And we tend to regard that as a tragedy, and we lament it. But at the same time, I remember going to a church revitalization conference that our denomination put on, and they pointed out that every church that closes funds, on average, 10 new church plants. And it makes me a little nervous that what will happen is Christian colleges will just enter this ruthless competition with each other. And I'm really leery of the idea that if the Christian college is the kind of extension of the church in some way, that we've become these just self-perpetuating organizations. We're simply trying to survive at any cost, and maybe that comes at the weakening of a number of us when it might be better to consolidate or to restructure in some way. So I also am not volunteering Bethel for that. I can't imagine too many people are offering that. But I could see denominations maybe getting to that point and wondering. I mean, I'm sure it's happening in seminaries even faster than with undergraduates.
Yeah, there was an incident of a Christian college somewhere in California, I believe, closing a few years ago. And I was going to look that up, and I didn't have the opportunity to do that. And when I heard that, I thought, wow, this is very dislocating for students. I mean, consider you're a sophomore. You went to this college. It's nearby. It's offering you the kind of Christian education that you want. And then after 2 years of schooling, it just all of a sudden closes.
Right.
And, I asked some people, well, what happened to these students? And they said, well, they were picked up by other places. Azusa Pacific or Occidental said, please come here and we'll accept your credits, et cetera. But that's a very dislocating thing for students and also faculty.
Yeah. And it will happen. I don't know if the details are public yet, so I won't go into the numbers. But as a result of the cuts that we learned about this past week, some faculty were laid off, but also programs were closed. And I don't know exactly how we're going to sunset those, but there might be some students that will just have to transfer if they want to complete that particular program. And it's dislocating. I'm sure it's going to be for our faculty. So, I mean, I guess the economic benefit would be if there are fewer options, maybe that reduces some of the pressure on recruitment and enrollment. Because we have a face screen for undergraduate students. So even though I think the Minnesota high school population is going to enter an upswing soon, a lot of that is driven, for example, Somali immigration, and we're not going to have Muslim students coming to Bethel anytime soon. So I think we're facing a stagnant or dwindling student population, and so at least a short-term solution would be, divvying up that pie into fewer pieces. I'm not sure that addresses some of the longer-term problems that we've already touched on. Plus the fact that we're competing with all sorts of other kinds of institutions of higher learning, including Lutheran and Catholic schools, but also, the University of Minnesota, the other Minnesota State institutions. So I'm not sure, whether by choice or by attrition, I'm not sure that would actually solve the problem. It would create the dislocation you talked about.
Well, in addition to closing universities, which is the extreme example, you just hinted at another possibility, and Bethel went through this, is laying off some faculty. And add to this, there's been a movement afoot in the past decade or so of hiring what we call adjunct faculty, people who are on a one-year contract, they're not on a tenure track process. And this is facilitated by the fact that the academic job market has not been very strong recently, and we are still, as a nation, producing as many PhDs as we did. So now we have this glut of PhDs, and so it's easy to hire people on the cheap. Is that something that you see as a solution, a possibly problematic solution?
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting is, if anything, from what I'm aware of, we've actually reduced our dependence on adjuncts. Our department has had to let go a couple of adjuncts, and it's some of that's coming into faculty load. I mean, like, one thing that happened with Bethel is we found out we had a lot of non-instructional teaching units, employment units. And so, I mean, I think we're moving a lot more classes back into the tenure track loads. But, I can see the appeal. If I were an administrator and I was looking to control costs, I would compare an adjunct to a tenure track position. And, I want to say that that had an impact on the quality of education, or at least on the commitment to the institution. I also know adjuncts who are terrific instructors,
right,
and deeply committed to their institution. So I think it's a facile answer to simply say, well, the quality will dip if you do that. One way or another. I mean, I wrestle with it also from the end of sending off gifted students who, we warn them about the glut, and yet they can't imagine doing anything else until they go to PhD programs, and this is very likely what they'll be doing. Chances of getting a full-time tenure-track job and staying in it are more and more slender, and So I talk with some of my students about this, what other options are out there, and one is the kind of adjunct career, where you're patching together pieces at maybe 2, 3, 4 institutions. I don't know. Maybe I'm probably just socialized into a certain expectation of what being a college professor looks like. And I mean, I actually got tenure and I got promoted, and so I'm one of the few. But I think people see attractiveness to those who are trying to cut costs and why that would be difficult for people in the track.
It is something very different for folks of our generation versus the newer set of PhDs that are just graduating right now. The expectations are very different, and this movement toward adjunct faculty, as you mentioned, some of these adjunct faculty can be spectacular teachers. They're very intelligent, smart people that people can pick up from. But there's also the problem, and we've talked about this in our own faculty, is the morale problem that it creates, is that you spend 6, 7, 8 years slogging through a very difficult PhD program only to get part-time employment or maybe a year-by-year contract at a university, and that just wasn't your vision of things. And wow, that's psychologically hard for a faculty member to absorb.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to whine about the academic life because it's a very desirable. I mean, I chose it in part because it's flexible. I get summers off. It gives me time to do research. It's very rewarding in a number of ways. But even at the tenure track, I mean, it's a kind of life that doesn't give a lot of immediate rewards. Increasingly, you feel frustrated by the quality of students. We were talking about remedial education last week. And that's got to be magnified all the more if you have much higher teaching loads, more transients. If you don't get the kind of institutional support, you know, you don't get back to development money, travel funds, things like that. It's got to be all the harder. So I don't know how to reconcile this, but you know, unless you just want to burn out, whether it's adjuncts or people on the tenure track, I hope institutions don't just view this labor as disposable and replaceable. It requires people who are committed and highly trained, and view teaching as something more than just filling heads with information. If that's all what we were doing was, then you know, fine, let's do MOOCs, and that would probably address the problem to some degree. And clearly, I don't think that's what higher education, especially Christian higher education, is about.
Well, let me. You brought up this term MOOCs, and people might not know what those are.
Oh, sure.
They are massive online. What are MOOCs?
massively open online courses.
Yeah, and so this gets to another issue that we brought up both with Joseph Castleberry and Hunter Baker on our previous podcast interviews. And it gets to the issue of a possible alternative solution to the crisis. You don't want to raise tuition. You don't want to reduce quality. But maybe we're in this interesting period of time, this information age, where the cost of information, of delivering this information, are changing, and we could possibly save money there through these online courses, through these MOOCs. Is that a possible solution? Are we looking at Christian colleges rethinking the way that they offer education, not the traditional come to the ivy-covered building, but rather right, let's do this through the interwebs?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure about MOOCs. I mean, I feel like generally there's been a backlash even in the past year as we started to get some initial studies about attrition and the kind of assessment that goes with them. Maybe we can come back to that. I mean, what I will say is that increasingly Bethel and similar schools are already doing online education. Right now, though, it's not to the point of disrupting the model itself. It's more this is another way to do a class. Perhaps it creates some flexibility, some convenience for students. You know, the way we're doing it now, I don't think drastically reduces costs or increases productivity or anything like that. It might help some students get through in 3 years instead of 4 years. The difference that would be interesting is there's proposals to develop fully online Christian college experiences where you dispense with the residential component, and whether it's 3 years or 4 years, you do it entirely online. I mean, it does reduce costs in the sense that you don't have to pay for a room and board, but for all the co-curricular programs, the football team, all the other things that you may or may not get benefit from or care to pay for. But it creates the philosophical problem of, can we do what we do when there's no embodied community? When we often talk about what we're doing as something more akin to discipleship, or at least it's not just intellectual formation, but has spiritual and moral and character formative components. And can you actually do that entirely at a distance where you never encounter your professor or a coach or a residence director? And it's hard to answer because no one really has tried that, at least at the level of quality I think we'd like to think we could retain. I think what we're worried about is what you get is, whether it's through MOOCs or something else, much larger class sizes taught by probably casual labor that's doing huge numbers of these classes for relatively low pay. And maybe that's what it takes, you know, to make college affordable. For some people, I guess as a parent, that's not what I hope for my children in the, it's going to be 15 years before they get to this. But that'd be hard for them. I mean, it certainly doesn't square with my vision of college. Maybe, again, I'm just socialized into the, you know, the nice lush green quadrangles and the college experience. But I think there is some, that would be a fairly significant change. As a historian, I want to be sensitive to the idea that the way we think of teaching and of research and of how these things are structured is not constant over time. This is, and it's a very old model in some ways. It's also, the way I do it is fairly new in some ways. And so I want to expect that it could change, but, you know, at a certain point, it would become something that I wouldn't be interested in teaching. It would be a very different thing than the thing I find very valuable right now.
Yeah, there's this tension between trying to keep tuition low and quality high, and people have championed this whole online idea because, as we talked earlier before, building costs are a big concern. But if you have online students, and Northwest University is expanding its student population by creating branch campuses using a lot of virtual online technology so that it keeps the building costs low but still can bring people together, it seems like an ideal situation. But as somebody who has taught and is teaching these online classes, there's a lot of downsides, and especially in terms of quality. You would say, well, you know, you just put it on to video and it works all great as if you were standing there in front of the class, and maybe students don't have as much interaction, but, you know, that trade-off's not too bad relative to cost. But as I have found doing this, you would think that this technology, online technology, is rather flexible. But one of the problems that I face with the online class that I teach is that once I did get it set up, recorded it, and put all the buttons and gizmos in place, I found that I was very reluctant to go back and change anything. So, interestingly enough, despite the fact that the internet offers lower information costs, lower technological costs, and should offer more flexibility, it actually doesn't. And I'm very concerned that my class becomes very stagnant. And the other thing with these MOOCs, it again, we're talking about the academic job market. Could Bethel or Calvin or any other college just say, you know, we're going to take a professor's class from Yale or Harvard, and they're going to teach it, and, you know, we don't need a lot of these other faculty members here, and, you know, it just boils down to maybe a couple dozen people offering a standard introduction course, and that really doesn't create the type of diversity that you want in the broader educational system.
Right. I mean, I guess I would hope if MOOCs are going to stick around that there would be MOOCs offered by schools like Bethel's and Calvin's and Wheaton's or Baylor's or Notre Dame's, but yeah, I guess I have some attraction to them, not so much for what they can do for 18 to 24-year-olds who still seem to be able to afford some kind of college education, but yeah, I'm more drawn to them as a way to provide lifelong learning, or for us to serve churches' adult education needs, or maybe to serve in the two-thirds world as ways to provide a kind of service to our brothers and sisters in Africa or Latin America or Asia. I don't know. I share all your concerns. I've only taught one online course over the summer, but it was one that I had very high hopes for, and we put a lot of time, you know, I think, creativity into it, and you're right, it's not terribly flexible. And I'm not totally assured that students have with the knowledge they took away, let alone the other kinds of less tangible things.
Yeah.
It also just, I mean, in terms of, I just felt very dissatisfied at the end of it, and maybe that's something I'll have to learn to live with or find other ways to find satisfaction in my job. You don't get the same kind of input that you do when you're actually in a classroom. You've got that one person who is kind of surprised to be tracking with you, and they find themselves deeply moved by what you're doing, and so that would have to go away.
Yeah, that is true. And to stay on my soapbox about online learning a little bit, again, I do online teaching, but I see a number of downsides from it. It's not only that the faculty member misses that interaction, but students do as well. They oftentimes think, online class, hey, I'll take this in my pajamas. This could be a real easy blow-off class, but it actually requires more self-discipline on the part of the student than a traditional class where they have to be in class at 9:30 in the morning. And a lot of students, in their young 20s or late teens can't handle that. And it's the quality issue comes up again and again.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. I mean, the studies I've seen that suggest that this work usually are dealing with graduate and professional programs where these are people who in many ways more mature, but they already have other responsibilities. They have no choice but to be disciplined about it. I'd worry a lot about an 18-year-old. Given that much freedom all of a sudden to make the kind of choices we want them to make.
Yeah, that's the exact experience that I've had. Let me move into your third possible solution to this fiscal crisis that we've been talking about here. And again, this goes back to Archibald's trilemma of, well, we want to keep tuition lower, we want to keep quality higher, and we don't want as much government spending on subsidies. But you know what? Here's a possible solution. We can keep quality high, keep tuition low, but we might have to give up on the realm of government subsidies. We'll take more government subsidies. Why isn't accepting more government subsidies a possible solution here?
Yeah, I'm not honestly sure how many more will be available. Generally, it seems like funding for education at the state and federal level is not exactly rising. But I mean, I think historically, a school like Bethel has had ambivalence about this, to put it mildly. I mean, on the one hand, I think the enrollment grew in the 50s, 60s because federal and state governments were subsidizing through various kinds of financial aid.
The GI Bill.
In the 1960s, Bethel outgrew its campus across from the Minnesota State Fairgrounds in St. Paul, and it bought this land from DuPont up in the suburbs. But it had a real hard time raising enough money to move up there, and there was this new program called, I think, the Higher Education Facilities Act that again, it was a way of subsidizing the growth in higher education. And the president at the time, the board, recommended to the nomination, well, we should apply for this, and it was tabled for 2 years. And then in 1967, it came up, and by, I think, 2-1, the annual meeting voted it down and refused to take those funds. And as I think I hinted at earlier, up until, I think, 2 or 3 years ago, Bethel refused to take federal research funds, whether it was NSF or NEH. Partly because we had a major private donor who made their gift, I think, conditional on us not taking the federal aid. So I think specific to Bethel and generally to Christian higher colleges, there's historically been this weariness of accepting the strings that go with public aid. And just in very recent years, we've seen the kind of problems related to health insurance and whether this covers abortions or contraceptives. We got sexuality will become a cutting-edge issue here as we move forward in the next few years. So I think I'm not honestly sure there's much more to be gotten beyond the kind of financial aid and other grants we get now, and I'd be very leery of abandoning what is distinctive, the things that relate directly to the faith commitments that we have, the kind of faith screens we have not just for faculty and for most of our staff, but for students as well. It would be hard to abandon that.
I want to close with your thoughts on this as we come to the end of our interview. You mentioned some of the trade-offs that might have to be made if you start accepting government subsidies. In the process of saying that, you're saying we have to really think deeply about our Christian character. Thinking more broadly about the U.S. educational system, I could pose a question to you and say, you know what, maybe there isn't a place for Christian colleges anymore. Maybe government subsidies for large public institutions or even smaller public institutions is the way to go, and that the time for Christian colleges, the time for Christian universities and Christian higher education more generally, it's over. Is there a case to be made that Christian higher education still serves a very, very important role in our modern and changing economy?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think generally, if I want to speak to a much more broad audience, the quality of Krishna higher education has risen. You know, the standards for what it means to be a faculty member, in terms of having the terminal degree, doing continuing professional education, being active in research. These are good schools, and they're accomplishing the kind of tasks that, whether it's a state school or a secular private school or a church-related or Christian college, you know, we're training good nurses and teachers and social workers and accountants. And so I think we contribute to the common good in that sense. What I'm more concerned about that going away would be the ways in which we serve the mission of the church, with, I guess, a capital C, and then specifically our denominations or local congregations. And this was really, I guess, my point in the open letter, was to get us to rethink what is the relationship between the church and the Christian Academy. Historically, a place like Bethel, the relationship, is Swedish immigrants who were trying both to kind of maintain a separate identity while also providing, English language learning and job skills so that the second and the third generations could rise up in American society. And to train pastors and to train missionaries. And some of that is still valuable, the training of church labor. A lot of that has disappeared, though, or it's been supplanted. And I think in some ways we kind of rest on those founding impulses, but we don't revisit them. And instead, I'd like us to think about what is the mission of the Church of Christ in this world and how do Christian colleges contribute towards it. And so in the letter, I talked about the ways in which what's distinctive about especially a Christian liberal arts education is the kind of holistic education you get, that we are not just filling minds with information, and we're not even just training people with marketable skills, but they're forming their hearts and their character. We're engaging in something more like discipleship, I think. And most American Christians will not have that kind of higher education, and probably is not feasible or maybe even desirable. But at the very least, we need to be training people then to be pastors or to be lay leaders within congregations who have that and maybe then can develop formation at that level. The other thing that really is important to me is that I sometimes hear the choice being made by local converged churches. Like, well, we give $1,000 or $10,000 to Bethel, but, why don't we give that to missionaries instead? Why don't we go pay for people to go to the unevangelized parts of the world and do missions? And I value that. I'm an evangelical. I believe in evangelism, and I want to witness the ends of the earth. I also feel like you're giving to missionaries if you give to a Christian college, because you are cultivating people who not only can go to the ends of the earth because they've had language training and they've learned about other cultures and they've had experience across cultures, but they're able to stand back from their own culture and to understand what it means to be in the world and not of it. And I think as evangelicals increasingly realize that this is a post-Christian society, that the mission field is everything outside their churches, they need to, I think, continue to rethink what missions look like and think about how supporting Christian higher education is training people to be missional in this society. But that's a very long-winded answer. I hope it's kind of compelling, or at least continues the conversation.
Oh, it's not long-winded at all. It's actually a very insightful commentary that you provided there and that you provided on your website, that it generated a lot of feedback and a lot of traffic to your website. How has that feedback been?
It's interesting. I mean, I think of categories of responses. One that was in some ways surprising, in some ways not, was just Bethel alumni who didn't realize there was any crisis whatsoever. And it's not surprising in the sense I'm not sure Bethel has tried to publicize this or do anything like an appeal to donors. I just got the investor's newsletter and it didn't mention anything about this. And so that was interesting. Then the second response was alumni on the blog or at Facebook or privately or in other places been talking about why they did value their education and reaffirming, I think, some of what I was saying in the letter. But what is interesting is the pushback it got, and that's what I'm going to try to address this week, maybe into next, at the blog. And a few things that came out were, maybe this is the fault of the colleges. Maybe they've detached themselves from denominations and churches. So probably the next thing I write will be about, just how committed are faculty at Christian colleges to denominations, the relationship between students and local churches was something someone raised. One common criticism was, I think I came to that before, was, well, maybe these colleges aren't very good financial stewards. You know, we don't want to give to a place that's spending so recklessly, that's building when it doesn't have funds. And I think that's an important point to come back to. The one that I want to probably push back most against is the idea of, in essence, that we're not good spiritual stewards. You know, why would I send my son or daughter to a Christian college that's more liberal than the denomination and they're going to lose their faith? And, you know, as professors, I think one commenter said, belittle their faith.
Yeah, look what happened to Yale, after all, over the many decades
exactly.
and centuries.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think there's that kind of drift. And then I think there's a healthier kind of, it's not drift, but I think there's a productive tension between colleges and denominations. In one respect, we are there to lead the church on mission. And so our faculty do have to sign an affirmation of faith that comes from the denomination. But in other respects, colleges are meant to be on a cutting edge, and they're meant to at least question assumptions. And the way we talk about it at Bethel is not that we want people to lose faith, but to make it their own. And to circle back to the beginning, I see this as a pietist concern. Pietists going back to the 1600s in Germany or the 1800s in Sweden or nowadays, Christianity is not something that can be inherited. You're not a Christian because your parents were. It's not something that you're not a follower of Christ just because you live in a Christian culture, or even because you can affirm a creed or a confession. There's a concern for authenticity. And I think one value of the Christian liberal arts is they do liberate people to choose to respond to the gospel and to answer the great invitation and then go out and follow the great commission. And that can be a rocky process. There are some of our students who then really struggle with faith. I mean, I've seen students in tears because they've never considered the relationship between faith and reason or the historicity of the Bible. And what's nice in a Christian college is we can raise those questions, but then we also, you know, that you've got the Christian community there to wrestle together, and you've got Christian mentors to help you with it. So I understand where the critique is coming from and the concern. I also feel like it is a risk, I guess, in a sense. I mean, we're not just sending people to be with like-minded people so that they can have their assumptions reaffirmed uncritically. I do think it probably, though, produces more thoughtful evangelicals and, I think, better witnesses to this culture if they have that kind of education.
Well,
I haven't written that post yet, so these are kind of skeptical out of thoughts, I guess.
Well, you left us with a great deal of thoughts to think about, and if our listeners would like to join the conversation, I invite them to go to the Pietist Schoolman website, where they can actually check out what you have been writing and join in on that conversation. And what a conversation it has been. So I want to thank you, Chris, for being on Research on Religion today.
Thanks, Tony. I appreciate the chance.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.